I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Now, taking sexual harassment into court. Up until now, most women never told about the harassment they endured. They left the job, they swallowed their fury, they got on with their lives, and even fewer ever sued. But Me Too and Time's Up are opening doors for women to take their cases to court. You might remember this moment from the Academy Awards.
Our voices joining together in a mighty chorus that is finally saying, time's up.
Today, a discussion about how the legal options are when you've been harassed and how well-equipped or not the courts are to deal with these cases. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you on this. Have you ever felt empowered enough in a harassment situation to not only report the harassment, but to take him or her to court? And what held you back from that? I think these accounts of why so few women and some men don't want to take these cases into court are important to our discussion this hour. 651-227-6000 to talk to me about whether you felt empowered enough in a harassment situation to not only report it, but to pursue legal action. 800-242-2828. You can talk to me, of course, about it on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Our guests this hour, Maya Raghu is Director of Workplace Equality at the National Women's Law Center, and they are holding the Time's Up Legal Fund. And Maya, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi Feldblum is with us. She's a commissioner of the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, and she's with us today from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, hi, given that so few women feel empowered enough to report harassment, I have to assume that even fewer of these cases are ending up in court. Is that what the numbers show?
Yes. Based on the surveys, only about 15% of women who experience harassment ever file a charge with the EEOC. And women have to come to the EEOC first. Filing a charge, we do an investigation before they can go to court.
And
obviously, it's a low number.
And Maya, how much of that is about, well, then I have to retain an attorney, and then I have to pay that attorney, and they're going to fight me with some, you know, potential big organization's legal fund. I mean, is it also about spending the money to pursue this?
Absolutely. You know, there are so many barriers to people coming forward to report sexual harassment, not least the fear of losing a job and experiencing retaliation. But another huge barrier is just the cost of pursuing a lawsuit. And for many people, there aren't a lot of attorneys in their area who will take on these types of cases, particularly for workers who are in low-wage jobs, because the potential outcome and reward isn't significant enough for the attorney to take the case in the first place.
Wow. So attorneys say, I'm going to put a lot of legal time and effort into this. We may not win. This is not worth the risk. Is that right, Maya?
Absolutely. That's part of the calculation and part of the reason why, for so many people, it has been so difficult to come forward and pursue a lawsuit.
So I understand that the Time's Up Legal Fund, this is pairing people who are reporting, right, through hotlines and other ways, with attorneys who are willing to take the cases. How does that work?
So we are the home. The National Women's Law Center is the home of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Since January 1st, we've received over 2,000 requests for assistance, and they are from every industry and every state in the country. And what we do is we have people submit their requests through our intake line, and then we connect them to attorneys in their area who have agreed to provide a free consultation or to take on these types of cases.
I understand that the hotlines have been really busy. Is that right?
Right. Absolutely. Like I said, since January 1st, we've received over 2,000 requests for assistance, and it is every type of situation in every industry you can think of.
Let me grab some calls here to Nancy in Albertville, Minnesota. Hi, Nancy. How does your situation fit with the discussion today?
You had said that if they called in and took it to court or whatever.
Right.
I guess I'm just thankful that when it happened to me, the person that I reported it to, I trusted, and he made absolutely certain that it was dealt with right there and I didn't have to take it to court.
Would you do you think you would have been willing to pursue it in court if the behavior hadn't stopped? And by the way, I think your situation is somewhat unusual.
Yeah, absolutely. I would have taken it. Just this, just what happened, I was extremely uncomfortable with it. And I went to my boss and I thought he kind of overreacted. I was like, oh, my God, you know, but no, he stopped it right there.
Wow.
Hi. And I'm extremely grateful for that.
Hi. Does that sound, given some of the other calls that we've had when we've done shows on this, that sounds fairly unusual to me. What's it sound like to you?
Well, I think we don't know how unusual it is. My guess is there are any number of situations where supervisors and bosses do something, and we don't necessarily hear as many of those stories. The problem is that there are plenty, plenty who do not do anything. And remember, the last thing a woman actually wants to do is to go to court. I mean, that's not only spending money, but it's just a very agonizing situation. So one of the things women need to understand is that if they come to the EEOC, they don't need to have a lawyer. Most people who come to us don't have lawyers. And there are things that we can do in a confidential way to settle the issue. But I must stress, the best thing is for employers and supervisors to be incentivized to do what they did in Nancy's situation and to deal with the problem promptly. And not enough of those people are doing that.
I was going to say, hi, do you sense a change in this, given how many reports are coming into the legal defense fund here and the conversations that we're all having? Has something changed where employers are willing to be more proactive on this?
My sense is that it has changed. Now, this is purely atmospherics. We don't yet have survey data, which is what we need. But based on the number of employers that are seeking out training, that are seeking out help, I have to believe they are beginning to change the incentives for supervisors and are telling supervisors, if you get a complaint and you do nothing, we are not going to be happy with you. And that changes the incentives. I think it is happening slowly.
Maya, what's your sense of this?
I would agree with Hi. I think there is a greater willingness on the part of employers to confront this problem and to be more proactive about it. And to really think about how do we prevent this from happening in the first place, which is a big difference from the way things have been previously. It's a real change in culture and attitude. But the problem is, if employers are doing the right thing, or they're getting better, they're just not talking about it. So we don't have a good sense of what they are doing and the impact that it's having yet. And it hasn't been long enough, I think, to measure that yet.
So,
what I will say is that, you know, based on the people calling into our legal network and the fund for assistance is, you know, there is still a huge need. This is still happening on the ground in workplaces across the country. And, you know, people who are experiencing harassment have a real need just to talk to someone to find out, you know, what do I do in this situation? What are my rights? Where can I go? And that's even before they decide whether or not they want to file a charge with the EEOC or pursue a lawsuit.
So this is interesting, Maya.
Don't misunderstand me.
Go ahead, Hi. Yeah.
What I want to do is let's not downplay the momentum that Me Too has created, right? That's my point. Let's not downplay what we've done or what has happened so far, but let's be very realistic. This is just a tiny step, but it's a step, right? To continue having energy, you have to have a sense of the steps that have begun to happen,
right?
But we are nowhere near the real culture shift that we need.
Maya, that's what I wanted to pursue with you when you said you sense there is more interest on the part of employers to change the culture to stop this from happening in the first place. We know that a lot of the training that employers do is not very effective. Actually, NPR is about, our newsroom is about to go through this, I think the whole organization, about an online training on sexual harassment. We know that the evidence says that a lot of that kind of training is not very effective. So what gives you a sense, Maya, that employers are doing stuff that would actually matter when it comes to changing a culture that stops this from happening in the first place?
It's a couple of different things. I think, you know, change and culture change especially starts from the top. So I think we're starting to hear the leadership of more organizations and businesses speaking up about this. They may not be saying what exactly they're doing to change business as usual around these issues, but that's an important first step. As the commissioner mentioned, there have been a lot more inquiries about how to move away from, you know, the online training, the DVD training that's half an hour, 45 minutes, that isn't interactive, that's not really asking people to think about how they would problem solve and react in a situation that's realistic to their workplace. And by the way, in 2016, the EEOC had a task force on harassment
right.
in the workplace, which the commissioner co-chaired, and put out a wonderful report with some
yes.
very specific and helpful recommendations about effective trainings and policies. So all those things are important. They can't be done in isolation, and they are part of a much bigger effort by workplaces that has to be taken to look forward, to be forward-looking and prevention, thinking about prevention.
Hi, I'm coming back on the effective training because I think that's really important to talk about, but I want to grab a call from Cody in Minneapolis. Cody, you're a lawyer?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer here in Minneapolis, and I actually practice in this area.
Good.
And I was listening to what you were saying about what your speaker was saying about, you know, why lawyers don't take these cases. And I guess in my experience, that hasn't really tracked our experience of why we don't take cases. We don't mind when damages are low because, quite honestly, in these cases, there's attorney fee shifting provisions. So we get paid if we win. Mm. Our issue is that the law in this area is abysmal. So for women. So what has to happen in order for these women to have a viable claim is they have to be harassed and pretty severely harassed, and then they have to report the behavior. If they don't report the behavior, the employer has a defense and, you know, and wins the case. And that's if it's a coworker. Now, if it's a supervisor, they don't have to report the behavior, but the supervisor does have to take a tangible action against them, does have to take an adverse action against them in order for them to have a claim. So the law in this area hamstrings us.
And the problem with that, Cody, just to play this out, is if often you're not reporting it because it's only going to mean retribution, maybe the loss of a job in your workplace.
Precisely. And like I said, I mean, we take cases that have very small damages, you know, available to them because, you know, we want to fight on behalf of these women. But the problem is often liability, not recovery.
I'm so glad you heard the show and you had a chance to call in. Maya, hi. What about that and how to change? Do you agree that the law is terrible on this?
Hi, Cody, and thank you so much for calling in and thank you for making those points. So I'd say a couple of things. One, we only have, I think, 7 attorneys from Minnesota that are part of the legal network. So I would really encourage you and your colleagues to join if you haven't yet, especially since you are open to taking these types of cases, which is wonderful. Your second point about the law being terrible, I agree with you. Especially at the federal level, there are a lot of gaps in who is protected under the law. And our standards in the law make it really difficult to prove harassment and hold supervisors and employers liable. That's why we're seeing a lot of interest at the federal level and from policymakers across the states about looking into how can we strengthen our anti-discrimination laws and sexual harassment laws so that we're protecting more workers, like independent contractors, who aren't protected under federal law right now, and ending all these attempts to hide sexual harassment through non-disclosure agreements and things like that.
Hi, what would you say about how what the legal landscape is like right now for reporting and pursuing these cases in court?
Well, Cody is exactly right. Thank you for calling in and for giving that very clear explanation. The law creates hurdles for women to win. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's one of the reasons why it's so important for employers to try to stop unwelcome behavior before it might rise to that pretty high level. So just to reinforce the problems with the law, first, unless it's a very serious case of harassment, right? I mean, requiring sexual favors or touching someone's, private parts. If it's just the sort of consistent, either sexualized or non-sexualized comments, under the law, that has to be pretty persistent over time, when an employer should actually shut it down right away. And number two, as Cody said, even if it might be found to be harassment, and this is for a coworker, if the person did not reasonably use whatever procedures the employer has, that ends up creating a defense for the employer. Mm. And as you noted, a lot of people might know that there is a policy for reporting, but they're not going to do it. And in fact, a significant number of people simply never report, even internally.
This reminds me of our sexual assault laws, too. Hi. Not all that different, right? A defense gets created if you don't report it in a certain amount of time, et cetera, et cetera. Now, they've improved a bit. I see the harassment laws are lagging.
Well, I mean, think about this. It's the Supreme Court who set out this defense. And from their perspective, as they explained in these opinions, they want to give the employer a chance to stop the harassment. And if the person never complains, then the employer never gets that chance. So it's not that they were wrong sort of conceptually to say, hey, you should use the employer's internal procedures.
Right.
What's not in there is an understanding that if the employer is not completely vigilant in making sure retaliation doesn't happen,
right,
then people won't use the system.
Call here from Jackie in Minneapolis. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a couple of quick questions. One is, when I went through a lawsuit and they settled after about 4 years, right before trial, first I did file with the EEOC, and at least at that time the EEOC was terribly understaffed. And my case was denied not because it didn't have merit, but because they had much more extreme cases. So I'm wondering if that's been rectified. And then my second question is that one of the things I'm not seeing in harassment training is most harassment has a culpability of the people around the person who is being harassed.
Mm-hmm.
They see it.
Mm-hmm.
When do we start training those people around the person being harassed how to document and help the person being harassed? Being harassed can't do it alone.
Jackie, these are great points. Glad you called. If you've just tuned in to the conversation, we're talking about why so few cases of sexual harassment end up in court, and how some of these legal funds, including the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, which is housed at the National Women's Law Center, is seeking to change that, match people up who have been sexually harassed with lawyers in their area who can take on those cases. Had many, many reports coming in here, and we're talking about just what it takes and what the barriers are for taking more of these cases into court. I'm asking you, if you've been involved in a harassment situation, did you feel empowered to report the harassment? Did you think about taking him or her to court? What held you back on that? And other questions that you have about how this works. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieNPR. By the way, also talking about more effective harassment training, because this is something that the EEOC has put out a big report on, and I refer to it every time we talk about this discussion. I want to grab a quick call here. Maya, this is back to pairing up attorneys in your area, and Lisa in St. Paul does that kind of work. Hey, Lisa, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Tell me a bit about what you're doing for gender justice.
Well, I co-founded this organization. It's a nonprofit advocacy organization that actually represents people in court who have harassment claims. I have personally done that work for 20 years and know many of the attorneys well in the Twin Cities who do that work. Gender Justice takes, we take online complaints at genderjustice.us, like United States, and we are available by phone. We have a website where people can find us and bring claims of sexual harassment. We will help them understand whether their claim presents a violation of law and help them either by representing them directly or referring them to local attorneys who would be able to help them.
Lisa, what did you think about what Hai and Maya were saying about what the legal landscape looks like right now, that it's really difficult to bring these cases into court and the law needs reform?
I completely agree. The law very much needs reform, and we are actually working at that on the state level. This session, we are in conversation with legislators about changing the legal standard under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. It isn't really possible right now to change federal law, although we support those efforts, of course. But at the state level, we might actually be able to make some change. We're asking legislators to make it clear that the Minnesota Human Rights Act does not follow this federal standard that has become increasingly hostile to sexual harassment complaints.
So, Lisa, will you stay on the phone for a minute while one of our producers gets your specifics about how to reach you for a future conversation?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. Thanks very much for the call. I wanted to ask you, Maya, about this issue of where the action is in maybe changing some of these workplace laws. I mean, is it in state capitals and Congress has been slow to really respond to this? What do you think?
I think that Lisa's right. And hi, Lisa. Gender Justice and the Law Center work frequently together. Yes, I think we all recognize that the prospects for reform at the federal level are difficult, even though there are wonderful champions in Congress who are working hard to address some of the hurdles in our current federal legislation. But yes, I think the real prospects for reform are in the states. As I said before, many, many states have already introduced legislation, and it's California and New York, of course, but other states all over the country pursuing really important reforms in the law to remove hurdles from being able to come forward, to hold employers and individuals liable for harassment, to make sure that people who work in small workplaces like domestic workers are protected under anti-discrimination laws. You know, and as I said before, to protect independent contractors as well. And that type of employment relationship is increasingly common in our economy. Can I go back to something Jackie said a minute ago?
I was just about to do that, Maya, and let me first go to Hai on this. Jackie was talking about more resources for the EEOC. Hai, of course, who doesn't want more funding? But is she right that you can't take as many cases as you need to take?
Oh, that's absolutely right, and I want to thank Jackie and Lisa for calling in, because Jackie's question is, you know, there weren't resources when she brought the charge. Is it any better now? And unfortunately, the answer is no, because we have not gotten any more funding than from Congress. And so the important thing, and why it's important for places like Gender Justice and this Time's Up Legal Defense Fund to exist, is that often all the EEOC can do is give the person the letter that gives them the right to go to court. But then they have to get a lawyer and go to court. If we can do more, right, literally do that investigation without the person needing to get a lawyer, maybe settle the case,
right,
then EEOC needs more resources. There's no way around that.
Maya, you were going to add to that.
Yeah, I actually wanted to address Jackie's other point that she made about harassment training and how it hasn't been as effective, and that she hasn't seen any attempt to address the role of coworkers and bystanders
right.
in harassment training, which is really such a critical point and goes back to our earlier conversation about culture change, right? People need to be empowered to step up and interrupt disrespectful behavior or harassment or call people out when it's happening and not leave it all on the shoulders of the victim or the target of harassment. And this is incredibly important when it comes to men, right? If we're going to see real culture change around this issue, not just in workplaces, but in our society as a whole, then men need to be allies here, and they need to use their power and their privilege to confront other men about their behavior when they see it happening. And we know from other contexts that that is what is really effective at stopping sort of gender-based violence and behavior in that spectrum.
This is such a good point, Maya. I'm aware of a situation right now where even where there's sexual harassment involved and even former employees are so afraid of the reach of the person involved that they don't want to talk about it. I mean, here's a group of people who are aware that this happened and may still be happening. And yet the intimidation factor, even when you've long left the company, is in full force. What do we do about that?
I think that's absolutely right. There are a lot of people, including men, who want to do the right thing but don't know how or who are afraid. And, you know, within the context of the workplace, that's where it goes back to leadership and leadership setting the tone and making it clear that, you know, empowering people to do that and making it clear that it's okay to speak up and that, you know, there won't be retaliation from doing so. That kind of credibility and trust takes a long time to establish. But one key factor in that is, you know, when someone has engaged in harassment, holding them accountable for that. And I think what we've seen over the last several months from all the stories coming forward is that too often that didn't happen. People looked the other way or were complicit, and there was no accountability and no consequences for harassment. If you want people to come forward and speak up, then you have to show them that they're not doing that in vain and putting their jobs and their economic security on the line.
You've got it. A lot of emphasis on how HR reacts, right, in these companies. I want to update you here from the Associated Press on this Maryland school shooting that we've been following. The principal at the Maryland High School has told parents last month that the school had investigated threats of a possible shooting and found that they were not substantiated. Of course, you'll hear more coverage of this on our news headlines, but also in depth on All Things Considered. To the phones here to Stevie in Ada, Minnesota. Stevie, thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. Appreciate
you. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
Appreciate it.
Tell me what you're thinking about.
Well, I used to work for a fairly small company of about 40, maybe 50 employees. I experienced a lot of verbal harassment, mostly just, you know, being called one of the girls. And, you know, just kind of put downs like that.
Mm-hmm.
When I did go first to my manager, he denied that it was a problem, that he should be able to call the girls anything he wanted. I went to HR, who was honestly nothing more than the president's secretary who got HR thrust upon her.
Mm-hmm.
She asked me why I couldn't simply learn to get along. And it went no further than that. I'm just wondering about small companies that don't have a strong professional HR presence.
Good.
And what they can do or what should have happened when, like you said, you're talking about the culture. It was a very testosterone-laden company, even though it was half women.
Hi, what do you do about the small company? And I want to say, Stevie says they don't have a professional HR department. Well, sometimes even the largest companies, HR, don't know what to do or aren't going to do it. But what about small businesses?
Well, my hope is that part of this public attention will make even small companies understand that every single manager and supervisor needs to be trained to know what to do when someone like Stevie comes with that type of complaint. You don't need an HR department to train supervisors about how to respond. And two things you need to train them about. One, sex-based harassment does not have to be sexual. Someone dealing with all these put-downs, that is, or that can be, unlawful harassment under the law. So point one to train them on. Point two, when someone comes with that type of complaint, you do not say, hey, get over it. You say, thank you for coming forward. I appreciate it. If what you say is happening, that is not okay, and we will stop it. That's what you do in response to a complaint. You don't need a whole HR department to train supervisors to do those two things.
Hi, back to this question of why sexual harassment training, anti-sexual harassment training, is often ineffective. Remind us about what your report found on that.
Sure. Number one, we did find that online training is simply not as effective as having a real person there who can engage employees in real-life examples of what is going on and take their questions and engage in a conversation about how to give feedback and how to receive feedback. So number one, really needs to be in person, really needs to be using examples that are relevant to that workplace. And third, one of the things we recommend employers exploring is precisely what Jackie originally raised about bystander intervention training.
Mm-hmm.
And as Maya said, that training will not work unless the leadership at the top says, we want you to learn how to intervene, and we will say thank you to you when you do that.
Wow. Call here from Chelsea in Minneapolis. Chelsea, you're an employer. I'm really glad you called. We haven't had your perspective yet.
Hi there. Well, you know, I'm calling because I have had probably, you know, every job until I became an employer, I've experienced harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And now as a female employer, I just am noticing when I'm talking to other females who maybe are also employers or even just friends that, and I experienced this also in the workplace, was that, you know, even if other women are noticing this kind of thing happening, I experience that they may also ignore it, and so, or even blame the victim. And so I'm kind of thinking about that as an employer, being a good listener, and like trying to learn how to talk to other women about this who maybe don't have the same perspective or don't maybe jump to victim blaming or jump to not very sympathetic to
right.
these situations.
Good.
Love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So Maya, I guess the question is how do you talk to other women in a way that will empower them to not tolerate it, to do something about it, to stop it before it happens?
That's a great question, and thanks so much, Chelsea, for calling in and for really trying to be a leader on this issue, because that's really what we need more of, employers who are willing to be leaders and help lead that culture change. You know, that's a really important question, and I think sometimes the reason why employers and even female employers ignore harassment or blame the victim is a couple of different things. One is that maybe they haven't experienced it themselves, so they perhaps don't have the empathy and they don't necessarily understand the difficulties that the victim is facing and the risk to their jobs by coming forward and how difficult it is to deal with this in particular contexts, especially male-dominated fields or if you're in a low-wage job where you don't have the same sort of power. The other thing is I think many women who are in leadership positions themselves sort of feel that they are in a precarious position, that their position of power is pretty tenuous, and that they, if they step out of line or if they sympathize or empathize with victims, that people aren't going to take them seriously, and that's going to undermine their power. So it's a really complex problem. I think coming together with other like-minded, sympathetic people is always a great start. And to have those conversations in small groups and safe spaces where people can talk about sort of their perspective or come to, you know, empathize with and understand some of the barriers and the difficulties that victims are facing.
You know, interestingly, given what Maya just said, I've had a lot of those conversations in real time, too. Like, I'm in this situation. What do I do? In a way that I was part of a whisper network, but in a way of saying, let's figure out what we can do here. That's something that has changed since Me Too. What would you say to our caller, Chelsea's question?
Yeah, I think what has changed is perhaps people feeling that it would be good if they could do something, but often people don't know what to do. You know, the whisper network is not as effective, right, as a support network. And again, that's the point about bystander training. Part of bystander training is to give people realistic options, including ways to support someone who comes forward with information. We have to give people those skills.
Hi, Maya. Thank you so much. Really good to have you in on the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And I will tweet out a link for the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund for the application for that. So that'll give you more information about how to apply if you need their help.